Wael Gonim is not a name I was familiar with until just a few weeks ago. Mr. Gonim was one of a million nameless minions in a vast internet empire, having risen through the ranks to become head of Google marketing in the Middle East. Though he's from Egypt, you would be wrong to think that he's stuck back in the Second Dynasty period without the ways and means to make it big in the modern world. He's with Google, after all. Like me and like so many of you, Wael has a Facebook page. Unlike myself, Wael loves his Facebook page. And he's adept at using it in new and startling ways. Case in point, last year, a young business person in Alexandria, Egypt, posted video on the net, allegedly showing police in the act of stealing marijuana for themselves at the site of a drug bust. Those police retaliated for their exposure by dragging the man from an internet cafe and, in full view of spectators, savagely beating him to death in the street. If you have a cell phone and you're standing in front of an internet cafe and the police kill someone in front of you, then you take photos and you go right back into the internet cafe and you post the photos to the internet and they go viral, which is exactly what happened. Wael Gonim saw those bloody photos of Khaled Said and set up a Facebook page called We Are All Khaled Said. The site became a rallying point for the campaign against the hardline Egyptian regime. And on February 11th, Hosni Mubarak, in power for 30 years, resigned and left Cairo. The revolution had begun. In June of last year, when Wael began seriously protesting police violence, he couldn't have anticipated the results his little one-man campaign would have. He could not have known then that hundreds and thousands would eventually take to the streets to call for Mubarak's ouster. Indeed, he probably thought it was much more likely that he himself would fall victim to the regime, disappeared like so many before him who'd raised their voices. He was arrested and disappeared for several days during those protests. He was shocked when he was released to see the unanticipated results of his anti-violence campaign. Those results that he couldn't have anticipated have now spilled out into countries across the Middle East, where hundreds and thousands of people are calling for a new day and a new way and a new age of freedom for all. We can't know what was in the minds of the people who first gathered this congregation back in 1836, when William Emerson wrote William Greenleaf Elliott and invited him to come over from St. Louis and see if a church could get started here in Alton. Emerson couldn't have anticipated what would happen. The people Emerson gathered together thought enough of the idea of forming that church that they called a new minister from Boston, Charles Andrew Farley, to become their first pastor. As Midge told you, Farley didn't last very long. Alton's a tough place. And when Farley's friend Elijah Lovejoy was murdered by a mob, Farley left really quickly, seeking safer surroundings. But the new little church fought on, going underground for a period, and then coming out of hiding to purchase this very plot of hillside where the local Catholic church had burned to the ground just a few months before. Why did those folks gather? Was it merely so they could be sociable and hang out with a few like-minded people? Was it so they could explore religious values that might help them in their daily lives? Was it so they could teach such values to their children? We really cannot know what drove them to meet in 1836 and to continue meeting through the years and to purchase land and build a building and then build another building and to persevere through thick and thin and the coming and going of members and ministers and staff and theologies and social movements and economic upturns and downturns and the rise and fall of industry in Alton and all the rest that all these years have seen. We can't know what they anticipated. All we can see are the results of their perseverance. with all the changes that have come through all the decades, I wonder whether or not they'd even recognize us. We are most probably not like them anymore. We are more like their unanticipated results. As such, we owe them a huge debt of gratitude for beginning something that they couldn't possibly have seen the end of, and for doing things that they could never have anticipated the results of. But I think I'm getting ahead of myself here. After all, it's not till next fall that we celebrate the 175th birthday of this congregation. We've already begun planning for a big celebration, inviting all kinds of other people from other local churches and perhaps Unitarian Universalist leaders from across the country to be with us and enjoy our hospitality and celebrate here. In preparation for that big celebration, we're beginning now to develop a 5-year strategic plan that should be ready for your approval in September, a strategic plan that will articulate a new vision for the future of this congregation and will outline the steps needed to make that vision a reality. That strategic plan will almost assuredly contain further building blocks for a capital campaign scheduled for the spring of 2012 that will help us make whatever facilities we have more environmentally friendly, as well as more welcoming to visitors, to our little kids, to our youth, to our aging adults, to everybody. There's a lot happening here over the next few months, and we're doing our best to plan ahead. But in the end, no matter how much or how well we plan, we can't anticipate all the results of what we'll do here together. All we can do is do our best to see out as far as we can see, articulate our vision for this congregation, and then do what we can to make it happen. That's what our forebears did. That's what we should be doing. That's what will best serve our kids and all those who come here after us. Today's been designated Heritage Sunday, a day set aside each year and dedicated to lifting up and supporting our church's heritage. One of the ways we support our church's heritage is by donating the offering on this day to the church's endowment fund, a fund set up a decade ago by a few dedicated, committed, forward-looking, and forward-thinking church members who were tired of worrying over whether or not the church would be able to pay each and every little bill that came along. If we only had $1 million tucked away, they reasoned, we wouldn't have to worry about where our next few bucks would come from. Well, that million hasn't materialized quite yet, but the endowment fund does have in it about $125,000, and it's generating $3,000 to $4,000 each year to help with annual operating expenses, which is not bad for a little church that for many years didn't think it could. Excuse me. But there's an unanticipated problem with the endowment fund. It's not in the fact of the fund itself. Plenty of churches would give their eye teeth to have such a reserve to back up their operations and to help support their outreach ministries. The problem is in the way we think about the fund. The problem is that we don't think of the fund as support for our mission, as a backup for ministry opportunities that might come our way. We think of it more as a hedge against future rainy days. When you think about an endowment fund that way, you know it's never going to rain hard enough for you to think that you can use it. When we think of the endowment as saving for the future, we get into trouble as well. And here's why. This is a church, not a savings institution. Our mission is ministry, not banking. We're supposed to be changing the world right now, right here. Not waiting to change the world at some indeterminate future date when we have enough money. When we let the endowment fund become more important than the ministry of today, we've misunderstood our mission. When we think of the endowment as something that's there so our kids never have to worry in the future, we do our kids a grave disservice. The people who've been members of this church all along have always had to think about how they allocated their limited resources and spent their money. You and I have always had to think about how we allocate our limited resources and spend our money. Our kids will be no different. They will learn how to allocate their limited resources and how to think about and spend their money. And for us to try to take that character building process away from them is not doing them any favors. What it comes down to is that it's the living church that always worries about having enough resources to do what it needs to do right now in the present. It's only the dead or dying church that rests on its laurels and lives on its savings and worries about nothing more than whether or not it can pay the few bills that come due. I am not saying that we shouldn't be adding to our endowment. On the contrary, we've not done our endowment fund any favors by not beating the drum for it enough. When we limit ourselves to talking about an endowment fund once a year on Heritage Sunday, that is not nearly enough. Perhaps it's been our tradition of shying away from ever discussing money, God forbid, but we should have been talking to each other down through all these years about planned giving and about putting the endowment fund and the church in our wills. If we were all considering putting the endowment fund in our wills, the endowment fund would soon begin to produce many more dividends than it does right now. Not simply for savings, because we're not a bank, but for present-day ministry, because we're a church. Wael Gonim is not a member of this church yet. But his work in overthrowing the regime in Egypt has direct ramifications for us and for the way we do things and for the way we think about things here in our little church. I think it's safe to say that I'm not the biggest Facebook fanboy in this congregation. But if Wael can change his world using social media as a tool of revolution, then so can we. We ought to be thinking about all the tools we can use for good around here. Yes, the church has a Facebook page, but are we as adept at using it in new and startling ways as we could be? Yes, the church has a web page, but are we constantly upgrading it and constantly making sure that it's as user-friendly and welcoming to first-time visitors as it ought to be? These questions came up in the UUNU 2.0 orientation class this week, when a little righteous anger was expressed by brand new members that had taken a long time to find us and realized that we may not be working hard enough or smart enough to get our message out there. As much as we, longer-term members, have tried over the years to put the word out, if we're not considering doing something new and startling right now, then we are already old news. And that goes for the web page and Facebook and Twitter and any other electronic media that comes along to connect people together. If we just use the tools already in our toolbox, we can anticipate the results of putting ourselves out there. We might just have a revolution on our hands. Like Wael Gonim, we could find out just how many there are out there who are tired of being held back by the same old regime. I know myself from hearing the experiences of people in this UUNU class and all these UUNU classes over the years that there are many folks out there who need to hear the good news that Unitarian Universalism offers them personally. That you don't have to check your brain or your heart at the door of our religious institutions. That each of us does have the potential for good as well as the potential for forgiveness when we fall short. That each of us can develop and should develop our own unmediated connections with the divine. That we don't all have to think alike to love alike. That we don't all have to share the same orientation to love one another. this happy Heritage Sunday, we take a moment to express our gratitude to those who came here before us. We, their unanticipated results, thank them for beginning something they couldn't possibly have anticipated the results of. We hope in our own day to muster the courage to do something similar for the ones who will come here after us, to call for a new day and a new way and a new age of freedom for all, and to share as widely and as startlingly as we can the good news. As the first minister of this church, Reverend Farley, put it, the good news that we are all children of God. A closing prayer in the words of Theodore Parker. May we learn by every trial and be strengthened by every cross. And when we stoop in sadness to drink of bitter waters, may we rise once again, refreshed and invigorated. Help us to live in unity with mind and conscience, with heart and soul, till your truth dwells in our understanding, and your justice enlightens our conscience, and your love shines a beatitude of joy in all our hearts. So may it be.